this last panel, I think, promises to be the most compelling. If for no other reason, then it's the one that starts to talk about, well, what do you do from here? And once there's a lot of policy pronouncements by the Vice President and the Caribbean Energy Security Summit, at some stage it has to also meet practical solutions, market solutions, and these are some of the things that we're trying to address in this panel. So I should begin by introducing myself. I am Dante Disparte. I am a fellow here with the American Security Project, a founding member of the Business Council for American Security. And then on the side, I founded and run a company that specializes in strategy, risk, and capital management on a global scale. So I could relate to some of the unique challenges that energy security in the Caribbean represents. I should also just confide that I was born and raised in Puerto Rico. And so, it's not hard to identify some of the issues that we've debated and that were brought up in the Vice President's summit. And the fact that Puerto Rico effectively is overlooked in many respects presents a challenge for me personally, and I would hope our counterparts and sponsors from Tropigas could shed some light on that as well. Beginning with the fact that on the island, energy costs are 4 to 6 times higher than they are on the mainland. On the island, we don't have access to OPEC financing, and a lot of the resources that we're marshaling that are ultimately taxpayer paid or sponsored are not available on the island of Puerto Rico. Political deadlock and all of the very challenges that you would see in any other Caribbean neighbor are present in Puerto Rico, yet none of the solutions at the federal level, the regional level, the local level are being marshaled in the same way. So it'd be interesting to hear some of this brought out. So we have an incredible series of panelists who will provide some opening remarks, and I promise to steward the good questions that will come from the audience as quickly as possible. But let me very briefly introduce each one. So first we have Dr. Vidangos, who is the senior Western Hemisphere Energy Officer at the U.S. Department of State. Surely had a ground level view of the impressive first of a kind summit that took place recently here in Washington, D.C. Vice President Biden talks about the energy epicenter has shifted to the Americas, and there's no doubt about that. And what the earlier panels have addressed is hopefully that in addition to the center shifting, that we also have a seismic shift in the approaches that are being made. And I know Dr. Vidangos will be able to outline some of the energy diplomacy initiatives that are in way. We also have our sponsor and an on-the-ground operator, Luis Humberto Berrios, Vice President with Tropigas, our generous sponsor for today's event, who will, I think, provide some unique insights for what does it take to really get some of these projects moving. When your counterparty is a state-owned utility, your counterparty has, in some instances, massive public debt that no private sector financing or no risk mitigation strategy really wants to touch. And so I think some of those points of view will be very interesting. And then last but not least, we have Chris Burgess, an operations manager for the Smart Island Economies at the Carbon War Room, will also provide some interesting insights. And again, so the intent of this panel hopefully is to bring this debate down to an operational level. What happens when you have to take initiatives and pronouncements and drive action with those? And so I'll open it up to Dr. Vidangos. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We really would like to thank the organizers of this event. As you know, this particular topic has become of extreme importance for the White House. It's not every day that you have the Vice President's attention so keenly on a topic as this in the world. So we're really, really glad that you've given us the chance to continue the conversation. We really hope that the summit we had recently was the beginning of this conversation. So fundamentally, the United States cares a lot about prosperity in the Caribbean. Vice President has made that very clear. We've also heard already about a lot of the challenges that are in the Caribbean, from the small markets, high costs of electricity, the difficulty for investors getting in. There are also policies that are very dependent on the country, some countries with unsustainable subsidies, others that are just working through that difficult challenge of how do you balance the needs of the utility with a bankable model that allows for the implementation of new kinds of energy? How do you shift to a modern grid? Having come out of the summit, I have to admit, I found that the Caribbean heads of government really trump American officials when it comes to beautiful oratory. So I am so inspired that I am going to use a bit of an analogy. Let's see how this goes. That we all know the analogy that a man cannot step in a river twice because the river is not the same and the man is not the same. I feel that this is actually a really great allegory for what's happening in energy in the Caribbean and the rest of the world. Right now, the Caribbean sees a window of the likes of which they have never seen before. Oil prices have come down. That gives space to think in a way that the region has not had the opportunity to do so in the past. Also, energy on the outside is not the same energy. We're not talking about this one-dimensional buyers and sellers of oil with single contracts. Now we're talking about energy as a multi-dimensional matrix, the term that the Latin Americans often like to use, in which you have different opportunities to adjust demand as well as supply. You have renewable energy and intermittence. You have the base demand. You have the opportunity of incorporating all of these in a way that makes sense for a particular country. And of course, everybody here is well aware that whenever we talk about the Caribbean, it's so easy verbally to group it all under one word. But the diversity of the Caribbean is stunning. The idea that we can put Trinidad and Tobago and Haiti and Grenada all in one word. We really have to keep in mind of the great diversity that's there. Also, more along the lines of how energy is changing the world over, the changes that have taken place in renewable energy in recent years are no less than stunning. Recently heard the head of the International Renewable Energy Agency, Adnan Amin, say, people are so excited that oil prices have dropped by 50%, but have they noticed that over the same course of time, renewable energy, especially in specifically PV, has dropped by 70%? This is a change that's worth our attention. And there was a time, I know that Michael in the former panel mentioned the statistic that it's very hard to get past 20% intermittent energy in a grid. But as we're seeing on the ground with efforts like those in the US Virgin Islands and also Aruba, that is changing too. We used to say you couldn't do more than 10% intermittence, and then it was 15, then it was 20. What will it be tomorrow? We're finally starting to see the work, and I know that the Carbon War Room has been instrumental in a lot of this work, that you really can get to 100. It really is possible, but that is a change, and that is new. We also see how the opportunities for gas are changing, and I look forward to hearing my colleague here from Tropigas speaking more to this as well. We not only have natural gas in the form of LNG, with the enormous $1 billion terminals that you need on either end, there are new opportunities for trade. The LPG market has gotten more flexible and more, you know, more able to adjust to the needs of the market that they're entering into. We have a window of opportunity that is very new, and I think, and the Vice President thinks, that this is really the time to move. There also have been demonstrations of success. There are those out there, I know, who've worked this field for a very long time who say it will just never get done because it's so hard. We know that that's not true because it is getting done. It is happening. The Dominican Republic has showed great strides in diversifying their energy matrix. They're reducing their losses in a sub-regional fashion, but they're seeing real progress in the areas where they've been able to focus. Aruba satisfied 30% of their energy with renewable energy. They might get to 50% by the end of the year, and they're steering towards 100% renewables by 2020. It looks like they're on track to do it. St. Lucia and Dominica are implementing their geothermal opportunities and resources, and Barbados, as we heard from our colleague at the IDB, is doing incredible things with renewable energy and has for a number of years, as the example of their standing out in solar water heating shows. If there's one thing you take away from my opening remarks here, it's that the experience of these countries can show us what is possible when a strong political will is combined with willing partners that share a common vision. And that is what the Caribbean Energy Security Initiative is about. We call it CESI for short. Coincidentally, the name of my sister-in-law, but no relation. The Vice President cares a lot about this topic, as I said, and sees the real issue here as the question of how do you use governance, finance, donor coordination to bring in the private sector. The private sector really is what will drive the growth. As he said at the summit, it's where the money is. But it is a complex, and as my colleague from OPIC said, self-reinforcing process to get us there. In the Dominican Republic last June, he announced CESI and mentioned the three pillars with which Brian noted of governance, finance, and donor coordination. At the summit last week on January 26th, the Vice President took this to the next level. The event was chaired by the Vice President and also had participation of the Secretary of Energy, the State Department Special Envoy for International Affairs, and a hash of other very high-level representatives. We had heads of state from many in the Caribbean, as well as very high-level delegations, as well as delegations from the World Bank, IDB, IMF, UN, EU, IRENA, other organizations that wanted to stand there and say, we stand with the Caribbean in trying to see change happen. There was a joint statement that was signed by 33 different delegations of the group. I believe that there was a link on the ASP website to it. Recommend that you see it. We're very proud of the work and the commitment that's endorsed in that. And there was a part of the event that also involved the private sector, because we feel that at the end of the day, the whole goal is, again, to get back to that driver for growth in a way that works. The Vice President also highlighted the U.S. commitments to the process. This isn't just about large structural elements. We have skin in the game as well. On governance, we have technical assistance in St. Kitts and Nevis, technical assistance for the development of geothermal resources that we hope could be a model for the region when we see success. Also, a number of partnerships with the Organization of American States, such as the Caribbean Energy Capacity Building Project. We understand that the IDB is working with our own Department of Energy on the natural gas study, which was so thoughtfully presented earlier. USAID has a $10 million project for clean energy in Jamaica, as well as many different projects on energy in Haiti. On the finance side, Brian already described a bit about the new OPIC team, which will be focusing a bit more on Caribbean and helping get that finance opportunity in for good projects that are having trouble finding it. And at the summit itself, I hope if Brian's still here, I hope he doesn't mind that I reparrot their announcement, which is that OPIC did announce it will disperse the first tranche of $43 million in financing for Blue Mountain Renewables in Jamaica. It's a 34-megawatt wind project. I'd just like to point out that 34 megawatts, small though it may sound for DC, is actually 4% of the total installed capacity in the country. It's not negligible. It's a real project. That isn't exactly the perfect kind of demonstration of how public and private sectors can work together. The project will be leveraging up to $90 million in investment into Jamaica, also helping them get off fossil fuel. On the topic of donor coordination, I'll say straight out, we know that donor coordination is hard. It's always hard. It always will be hard, and the Caribbean is no exception. But there are many different players in the Caribbean that are all trying to swing in the same direction, but may not have the cohesion to do so as efficiently as we really could do. One of the main themes at the summit itself was the fact that donors working together with the Caribbean, under Caribbean leadership, really can do this better. And if we do this better, we can really stand with our colleagues to get them to achieve their goals. This isn't about the goals of the United States government. This isn't about the goals of any other institution. This is about the Caribbean achieving what they've set out to achieve. There's also a diversity of players. You have the bilateral donors like Canada, Mexico. New Zealand is even involved in the Caribbean. There are also the multilaterals like the UN, UNIDO, and the EU have been partnering for a donor coordination piece and a renewable energy center, as well as the international finance institutions, the World Bank, the IDB, the IMF, all have a role to play and all have a consensus that it's valuable to do it better. The World Bank recently at the summit put forth a proposal to try to make a donor coordination mechanism to keep this conversation going after the summit. The goals of this proposal are to fully empower the Caribbean in the process, make sure it's under Caribbean leadership, build on existing efforts, bake in all of the different pieces that have already been done in different places, and enable smoother coordination. The next steps is that the donor community, together with the Caribbean, will be refining that proposal to make something that really will be effective on the ground. And finally, as Brian O'Hanlon said so well, all of these areas self-enforce and work together. We can't operate by doing cooperation in the Caribbean as a series of one-offs. And so often in the past, when an organization would like to do something useful, they go in and do one study, set up one solar panel, work with one policy. At the end of the day, if we really want to see transformational change, you have to get it from the beginning to the end. And that's something that we have seen ourselves in our own country, whether you're talking about New York City or the U.S. Virgin Islands. And again, you know, I think it's interesting. We started this conversation a bit with the talk about the American territories in the region, Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. From where I sit, we actually think about them all the time. And there's no sense that they're being left out of the conversation. It is true that there are different tracks of funding that support the Puerto Rico and U.S. Virgin Islands. But for instance, the Department of Energy had a program for comprehensive reform in the U.S. Virgin Islands. USVI had all of the same problems that a lot of the other countries in the Caribbean are facing. high electricity prices, high dependence on heavy fuel oil, inefficient infrastructure, difficulty getting the finance to change it. With the comprehensive reform that was largely funded by Recovery Act funding, which is the kind of funding we would have trouble bringing to our international parties, but it is something that we can bring to the U.S. Virgin Islands. They were able to implement a comprehensive reform program. They brought all stakeholders to the table. They looked at all of the opportunities that were available in a technology-neutral form. They picked a form that seemed like the most strategic mix for them, which in their case happened to be a mixture of renewable energy and LPG. And with that uptake, they've already been able to see 30% savings in electricity bills to the utilities, 20% reduction in emissions. And there's a sort of a nice example here that one photovoltaic array at the Cyril E. King Airport already saves $1,000 a day for the Port Authority. So this can work, and we've seen it work. So in closing, as the Vice President said, we can do this, and now is the time to do it. There is the expression that no man is an island, but I would go so far as to say that no island is an island either. That at the end of the day, we all stand together on this. We want to support our friends and colleagues in the Caribbean, and we want to do so effectively. The Caribbean has a one-of-kind opportunity here, and we hope to help them make it happen.
Thank you, Dr. Vidango. So it's good to see such leadership at the State Department. So now let's see if that leadership holds true as well in the private sector. And so we'll hear a few words with Luis Humberto. Thank you.
Thank you all. This has been a sponsor for the event. This is the first time we've participated. I want to thank the American Security Project and every single one of the speakers who have been outstanding. I was looking over my notes, and pretty much I've got nothing left to talk about. So if you hear these things more than twice today, bear with me. It's issues are redundant. Mm. But I think we've all touched on the points that due to a lack of natural resources, and obviously we're talking here about oil, not solar and wind, every single island in the Caribbean is completely dependent on imports. On fuel imports, mainly oil. It used to be that it all came from Venezuela. That has changed dramatically. There pretty much are no imports from Venezuela anymore into Puerto Rico, at least. And some of it also came from the refinery that Jovenza had in St. Croix, which has recently shut down, or is in the process of shutting down. In Puerto Rico, our company is an importer and a retailer of LPG, specifically propane. So you will see that my remarks will be more geared towards the use of propane. But I'm willing to take questions on other fuels if necessary. Well, obviously we've been talking about the shale gas revolution and what has happened in the US and the increase that it has caused in levels of natural gas. When some people refer to natural gas, they think of the gases coming out of the earth and automatically reaching their building through a pipeline. And obviously that's not the case. Within the natural gas mix, you have several other hydrocarbons. You have methane, you have ethane, propane, butane, methane being the one that's mostly used for electric generation. These increases in production, along with current EPA regulations regarding emissions, have been causing and will be continuing to cause a shift on power generation from coal and other dirtier fuels to natural gas and its alternatives. The case of Puerto Rico, per se. In Puerto Rico, generally speaking, our power plants are fuel run. There are two privately owned power plants, the Ecoeléctrica power plant in the south, which runs on natural gas, and the AES power plant, which runs on coal. The rest of the locally owned infrastructure, owned by PREPA, the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority, pretty much runs on either bunker or six fuel oil and diesel. With the increase in volume of shale gas, an abundance of propane, butane, and other hydrocarbons became available, opening an opportunity for production of energy with different fuels. We don't have to just look at natural gas. We can look at propane, we can look at ethane, which is becoming very popular topic as we all sit here. There are many people looking into opportunities with ethane. We presented before the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority in March of 2012 a project which would take the combined cycle section of the San Juan power plant, which is a 450 megawatt turbine system, change it from diesel oil to run on propane. At that time, with the market conditions being what they were, this would have created savings for the power company of roughly $150 million a year, just on those two turbines. Not to mention future savings when you would convert additional turbines to that fuel. This project that we presented could have been completed or could be completed within 120 days if need be. As opposed to, and sorry if I'm skipping a little bit, everybody talks so much about everything else that I'm just skipping through my notes. So. But compared to a natural gas project, if we were to do an LNG import terminal, you're talking about 4 years in permitting. At price levels that are currently in the market, you're looking at building LPG infrastructure for one-third the cost, one-fifth the cost of LNG infrastructure. And on a million BTU basis, prices are right there. They're pretty much at the same level currently. So you're talking about a project that can provide instant savings within 120 days and at a time when it is definitely needed in Puerto Rico. As most of you know, we're going through some financial situations down there. We don't see this as a solution just for Puerto Rico. Propane is obviously a green fuel. For the other island markets, each and every one of the speakers here today have mentioned the costs of LNG and how expensive it is to do the infrastructure. The project in St. Thomas and St. Croix, WAPA, the VI WAPA, the Virgin Islands Water and Power Authority, they studied the possibility of propane and went ahead with it. They should be burning propane within the next three to four months, creating huge savings for their clientele and the residents of the USVI. In Puerto Rico, we have the technology and the means to get this done within the 120 days, as we said, and at no cost to the authority. We provided all the capital and I'm sorry, I'm completely lost because everybody actually said what I was gonna say. I'll keep it very simple. The technology's there, let's just not look at LNG. Let's look at other fuel sources. Let's combine the different fuels that we have available to create a greener footprint in the island. The best way you can bring about socioeconomic change is lowering energy costs. In Puerto Rico, energy costs right now are roughly 28 cents per kilowatt, 26 cents per kilowatt. Florida, 12 cents. Some parts of Texas, 8 cents. It's just unsustainable. People are looking for a savings. People are looking for a way to keep their operations in the island. Combined heat and power projects are taking on a very important role in the possibility of continuing those pharmaceutical concerns and manufacturing concerns in the island. So with that said, pretty much the synthesis as well of what we're talking about is, as I mentioned earlier, let's take a look at the whole picture, get to a fuel mix which fits each individual client. In the cases of the islands, and it was mentioned very well, we can't look at the Caribbean as a whole. Each island has its own set of intricacies. And each one has, for example, St. Thomas and St. Croix have a larger electric demand. They have turbines in their power plants. Tortola, the other smaller islands, use engines. Engines can't be easily converted to LPG. They can be converted to natural gas. But when you look at the economics of bringing the natural gas for such a small consumption, for such a small volume, it doesn't pan out. So that's where we think. And projects such as what we're talking about with OPEC and this financing, where you can bring in more efficient machinery. In the case of Puerto Rico, we have, within the PREPA grid, you have old boilers that have heat rates of over 15,000. That means you need over 15,000 BTUs to provide 1 kilowatt of energy. Modern systems can do that for less than 7,000 in a heat rate versus, which is what we're trying to go after with the combined cycle section in San Juan. That is the most efficient asset that PREPA actually owns. The other most efficient assets are obviously the private assets, Ecoeléctrica and AES. So with that said, we're looking forward to being able to continue to present this with the lowering in oil costs and the lower prices. The savings have reduced somewhat. Instead of $150 million, maybe a year, it's now around 80-something million dollars a year. But I think that's pretty good. I think that's, if you think about a short-term project, which can be done within 120 days and with a commitment of 5 years, $430 million total in savings sounds pretty good for an economy that desperately needs it. Yeah. So with that, and my apologies for jumping all over this because obviously I got lost, I'll pass it on to Chris.
Thank you. Thank you, Humberto. It would appear that the private sector leadership is present. Perhaps what's lacking is the political will and other issues.
I think what was missing was my reading glasses. So let me see if I...
All right. So the carbon war room, Christopher, tell us all about it.
Yeah, sure. I do have a couple slides. It's not much, just to give you some context. So while he's bringing that up, I'm Chris Burgess. I'm the island's operations manager for the Carbon War Room. And I want to thank Andrew for making sure there's a token environmentalist out of three panels. So here I am with my buddy from Tropigas here. So now we'll talk a little bit about integration and how the fuel's going.
The other speakers, so.
Yeah. So, I haven't been with the Carbon War Room long, so I apologize. I'm not the institute of knowledge that Justin Locke is. I've only been with him about 2 months. Before that, I was a renewable energy developer here in the Mid-Atlantic, about 200 megawatts between West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Maryland, and a little bit in Africa and a little bit in the Caribbean, which attracted me to the Carbon War Room, which is very focused on market approaches to reducing carbon emissions, and for getting very high penetrations of renewable energy into small island economies where we feel that the delta between price, right, versus fuel oil or diesel costs is at the point now without subsidies. So, and I'll show some examples of that. So there's a lot of, you can go back, I just wanted to talk about the alliance real quick. There's a lot of little logos on the bottom. So the Carbon War Room is the brainchild of Sir Richard Branson. It was formed with a number of other board members I won't go into, but obviously he's the big bucks behind it. And he's very much focused on market-based approaches, being an entrepreneur that he is. And he wanted to focus on several areas where, after a McKinsey slideshow, you can check out on TED Talks, it actually shows the graph where there's what he calls climate wealth. There's so many market opportunities right now for the private sector without any new government subsidies, without a lot of new R&D, and he focused on aviation, shipping, trucking, energy efficiency, and islands. And islands is the only geographic one, and it's really the kind of the showcase right now because it's very popular along with Vice President Biden's remarks and everything that's going on geopolitically with Cuba and Venezuela. We feel like we want to be a part of this mix. So we feel like we're not a think tank. We're a do tank, right? And the counter opposite of that coin is the Rocky Mountain Institute, which has been around since I was reading college textbooks in, you know, 70s, I guess. So we also have a partnership not only with Rocky Mountain Institute, but with U.S. Department of Energy. They've been a big help for us on the energy efficiency and in the playbook process, which I'll get into here shortly. Okay, next slide. So the Carbon War Room came up with this something called the 10 Island Challenge. And it wasn't originally the 10 Island Challenge. It was a challenge from Sir Richard Branson at his Necker Island estate when he had some leaders from the Caribbean countries there. I guess it was in February. And out of that 10 Island Challenge became this huge initiative now, which we want to take 10 select islands, all in the Caribbean, to very high penetrations of renewables, over 50%. And I'll get into that here shortly. But our goal and our mission is to accelerate renewable energy opportunities in island economies in the Caribbean. We want to develop a commercially viable renewable energy model that can be shared and utilized for the private sector. And my friend from OPIC has left, but we want to catalyze the flow of private investment into renewables, where developers such as myself before were very risk averse to go into these areas. Next slide, please. So Natasha touched on this, and this is, you know, this is my slide. So she kind of stole it from me, but but it is about a process rather than one-off projects. There's a lot of donor agencies down in the Caribbean doing one-off projects where they do a couple solar panels on a hospital or, you know, the prime minister's estate or something like this. And it's good. It gets education out there. It helps get some of the myths and the stigmas away from renewable energy. But it doesn't do much to transition the economy. And that's where this playbook process is on the contrary of that. And that's what the Carbon War Room is all about in our partnership with RMI and Department of Energy. And I'll go through that really quickly. Next slide, please. So the playbook design is a process, and it's a process to engage all the stakeholders in an island. So most of the time you have a really excited ministry who wants to do something politically, wants to do something for jobs, wants to do something to get reelected again. And then you have the utility who is stuck in their ways, who have contracts with Petrocaribe or some other suppliers. They've got their distribution system that's old and antiquated and kind of rickety, and they have to keep it stable. And, you know, it's hard to get those two folks on the same page. So the playbook is really all about setting the vision, where we can make win-win scenarios for the utility and the ministry and the people of that certain economy or that island. And that takes time. So we spend a lot of time in the island engagement process, which is really phase zero, and then setting the vision, where we can really outline what can be done very quickly, the low-hanging fruit, such as LED lights, hospital retrofits, and then things that are going to take a little more time, like a 3.2 megawatt system on a 10 megawatt, you know, total capacity distribution system, right? So you have automatically, you have 30% on that particular island. So anyway, we take the island through this process with a, you know, binding MOU, and that's where we engage them for the long term, not just the one-off project. And where, you know, where the kind of rubber meets the road is phase three with project preparation. And that's really where the bottleneck is. And if you talk to the folks from OPEC, some other folks in this room, it's not a lack of capital. The capital is out there. There's donor agencies, the IDB, there's the CDB, and obviously there's OPEC that want to do projects. The problem is they are not bankable. They're not bankable because they weren't developed correctly, and they don't have the right risk aversion. So that's where the Carbon War Room comes in, is to clear up that bottleneck with bankable projects. And then we don't just go away after the RFP and the EPC contractor comes in and builds the solar farm or wind farm or battery backup system for the utility. We stay engaged throughout the process, and we create a community of practice, which is going to be an online portal where practitioners, nothing against the politicians, but it's not anywhere they play. It's where all the utility practitioners can play, where they can understand grid stability on certain small distribution circuits, just like their counterparts, say, St. Kitts, St. Lucia type of situation. And then we go through operation maintenance, which needs no explanation, and then phase six, which is how do we improve that process? We hit the reset button, we go to the next project on that island for phase one again. Next slide. So I touched a little bit on the community of practice, and this is something that's a living collaboration website where where utilities can get trained, where entrepreneurs can get trained. It's a web presence. It's a copy of the playbook. You know, any public data from a utility can be shared there. So you can look how harmonics and voltage play with each other against renewable energy penetration. You know, as Natasha said earlier, there was all this stigma about how many percentage points of renewable energy you can get into a grid. That keeps changing. That doesn't keep changing just because of technology. It's really software driven. I mean, software and smart grids can run these small networks without a ton of storage. And we're seeing that right now in Aruba. Aruba's got 30% renewable energy with zero planning. I mean, it's just ad hoc, right? I mean, now they're engaged with us and they're going to do an integrated resource plan. But I mean, that's the direction it's taking. The other part of that obviously is the financing. So we want a clearinghouse, so to speak. We don't want to be so much the donor coordination, but we want to make sure that all the financing options are available to these small island countries. Next slide, please. So how do we measure success? Well, we measure success obviously by the reduction of carbon, but also by the adoption of the playbook throughout the Caribbean, the community of practice and how many users we have in the community practice, how much financing is available to the region and it actually being utilized and not set on the sidelines like it has been for the last few years, and generating capacity. So how many megawatts do we have online and what the percentage of grid integration is. So right now we have 6 MOUs. We're not quite at 10. We hope to be at 10 by the end of the year. But right now we have an MOU with Aruba, Bahamas, Colombia, Grenada, St. Lucia, and Turks and Caicos. And people are like, Colombia? Yeah, Colombia is not a Caribbean nation. They're not an island, but they do have 2 really cool islands off in Nicaragua called San Andreas and Providencia. And we're able to take Providencia up to 80% renewable at about 21 cents per kilowatt hour. Now, that's generation costs. That doesn't include profit or distribution, so it's going to be a little bit higher. But that's pretty amazing, you know, for a small island grid without any scale that you can take them there. And this is all DOE and RMI research with the market rates today. So some of the fast movers out there you can see up on the slide. I'm sorry. Next slide. So we have St. Lucia that any day now, I'm thinking next week, there'll be an RFP on the street publicly for a 3.2 megawatt PV system. That will be the first grid integrated solar PV system in St. Lucia. They have a very large grid for the Caribbean, about 78 megawatts altogether. We're also doing a waste to energy project for them. And I temper that a little bit because right now it's just an RFQ. We're just seeing the viability of the project from a from an economic standpoint. LED street lighting we're doing on most islands. San Andreas and Providencia I mentioned earlier. And the Bahamas is very aggressive with a 20 megawatt hybrid solar project, which we're starting off here in the first quarter. So with that, I'll leave it be. Just wanted to showcase that there is a very excited NGO in the region now that's partnered with Rocky Mountain Institute, Department of Energy. We have a partnership now with the Clinton Climate Initiative. So we're trying to really be the sharp end of that spear in the region to get projects from just concept to really bankability. And I think that's been the bottleneck to date. So thank you, Dante.
Thanks, Christopher. Yeah. And it's always good to see the NGOs are often the meeting point for public-private partnerships to blossom. So it's interesting to see that the Carbon War Room is focusing on islands as well. So I thought I would open up the conversation, and I could see there's a lot of very eager questions in the audience. So I will just ask one question of the panel, and perhaps this is directed to our colleague at the State Department, which is that in the Caribbean, you have this dilemma of access and affordability. Mm-hmm. So in Haiti, last check, 28% of the population has access to electricity. One island or one border over in the Dominican Republic, it's closer to 96%. Mm-hmm. Puerto Rico, the number is 100, but yet Puerto Rico then underscores the affordability issue. So in a case as acute as Haiti's, what, if anything, came out of the conversations with Vice President Biden or any mandates within the State Department to really address the Haitian sort of narrative and how do we power that island specifically?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. And of course, Haiti is seeing a level of challenge that I think can be argued as unmatched, even in many places in the world. I would say that at the actual event, there was very little honing in on a specific solution for a specific island. I emphasized that every solution has to be tailored to every island, not only because it's true, because also when you have all of the heads of state, when you have all of these high-level delegations discussing energy, it's an opportunity to try to see where there's a common message that's relevant for all. And we definitely worked very hard to find those areas where there are common areas that make a difference. Bringing in the private sector matters. Getting the governance right matters. Ensuring that finance is accessible absolutely matters. But then the moment you get any further into the conversation, you have to think a lot about the specifics of that context. So in Haiti, for instance, you know, the health of the grid itself is not very good. It's not very strong. There isn't interconnection even between communities. So there's an infrastructure problem. There's a challenge with getting the governance to stand up. There's a challenge with corruption, I understand, as there is in many parts of the world. But as a result, in the particular conversation with the vice president, the major messages were those that were relevant to all. But at the end of the day, to really see a transformation in a place like Haiti, all of the partners have to work together, have to align the message, align the vision, and then tackle those specific challenges.
Okay. So why don't we turn it to the audience? So we'll do the usual point of order as stipulated by General Cheney. So if you make ask a question rather than make a statement, and then we have a roving mic. So by show of hands, whoever comes first. So we have this gentleman right here.
Thank you. I'm Fred Hutchison from LNG Allies. Natasha, this question is for you. I think that the Caribbean has perhaps more in common with Central and Eastern Europe with respect to some of the energy security challenges than most people realize. And my sense about that is that you guys at the Carlos Nemos shop get all of this. But there's a real disconnect because the next set of projects that are coming up through the process are more suited size-wise and charge-wise to some of these other markets. And yet, they're years and years and years away at DOE and at FERC from getting their approvals. So how can state help the rest of the parts of this administration deal with some what I think are some real issues with the projects that can really be of benefit both to the Caribbean and as well as to Europe?
Thank you very much for that comment. It's a very well taken point. Very often, it's easy to think that only communities that are surrounded by water are islands. But at the end of the day, any isolated communities with a particular size really have an island-like energy sector. And very often, we're seeing new opportunities in different forms of natural gas that could really address those particular issues. On the issue of regulatory barriers. Of course, the State Department doesn't have the lead on the regulatory side, as I believe most in this room are well versed upon. But I would say that at the end of the day, you know, if you talk to certain natural gas companies, they're ready to invest in the Caribbean. There are companies that have excess capacity, that have LNG, that are ready to sell to the Caribbean. They're ready to sell tomorrow. The question is, why aren't they there? And at the end of the day, it comes back to the point that both of my colleagues made, which is the bankability of the project. What is it that's preventing those commercial deals from going through? At the end of the day, it's going to be commercial. So why isn't it commercial yet? And every time we've followed that thread of the conversation, it leads us right back to where we started with governance, financing, and coordination.
And I can't imagine that Jones Act legislation helps too much, right? Right.
In Puerto Rico's case specifically, San Thomas and St. Croix have Jones Act waivers, so you don't have that issue in those two islands. But in Puerto Rico's case specifically, we cannot import any U.S. sourced LPG or natural gas because there simply aren't U.S. flagged LPG vessels. There was one small barge, a Poinciana, which is a 50,000 barrel barge, but it's currently deployed in the Northeast, and there simply isn't the access to production to U.S. production in Puerto Rico. Obviously, the extent of U.S. production has driven international prices down, so we do get some benefit from just the glut of product that's in the market. But it definitely would be helpful to have access to refineries in Houston and the product coming out of Houston, definitely. Mainly Houston, LPG Houston. You mentioned Crowley and Jacksonville. They do have some LNG coming out of there, but it's isotanks. That is an expensive delivery method and unsuitable for a power plant. You just if you were to imagine, if you're talking at the San Juan power plant, which is the one we were looking at, or any, a 400 megawatt power plant is roughly 15,000 to 20,000 barrels of LPG a day. There's no way to truck that in. There's no way to do that on an isotank basis. So as long as you don't have the infrastructure there, it's simply impossible to fuel a power plant with LNG.
Hold on, the mic will come.
My name is Colleen Newman. I'm with the American Association of Petroleum Geologists, but I worked for the governor of Puerto Rico on energy policy for 4 years, so I appreciate this conversation just in general, and Tropa Gas and talking to them was fun to do today. So I wanted to ask Natasha a question, actually. I know one of the things that I followed quite a bit was the Energy and Climate Partnerships of America's initiatives, and one of the things I wanted to know is how does that work dovetail with this new initiative the Vice President is putting forward, and has it kind of helped you kind of jumpstart it all?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes, the Energy Climate Partnership of the Americas, or as we call it, ECPA, is still alive and well. There will be a ministerial. I understand that will be hosted at some point, and probably the first or second quarter of this year. Dates, I believe, are still being set, so stay tuned. But ECPA has very much enabled a kind of conversation about transforming energy sectors that hadn't been possible before that point. It really, for those who aren't familiar with ECPA, it was an innovated initiative, Summit of the Americas initiative, which seeks to create a platform for multiple countries to come to and decide what they would like to do. So Chile could partner with Mexico on energy efficiency. An island could partner with Brazil or with Colombia to try to reproduce what was happening in San Andres. And there was a clearinghouse that's organized by the Organization of American States that keeps a lot of those flows going. This particular initiative, CESI, is a vice presidential initiative, so it stands alone, it's on its own. But I'd say dovetail is a great word for what it does with the rest of the efforts of ECPA. The Caribbean participates in ECPA. We expect the Caribbean will be participating in the ministerial that happens this year, and we hope to advance the goals under CESI through the ECPA ministerial as well. So we have multiple trains to push a lot of the same values.
Great. So in the back.
Couple of questions, if I may. You referenced the myriad of international donors. Does that mean that for U.S. businessmen, those are additional sources of funding? And secondly, is there such an equivalent, say, carbon credits available in the Caribbean? Mm-hmm.
So maybe do you want to take a crack at that one?
Yes. Yeah, I can. In terms of capital, and I'll use OPIC as an example since they were a panelist earlier. They require 75, they provide 75% of project costs after a very, rigorous due diligence process. So 25% of the cost of the project would have to come from somewhere else. Now, it could come from a donor agency. I think the only requirement they have on that 25% is that another quarter of that, 25% of that 25% has to be from the U.S. So they could take donor money from anywhere else. So that's specific to a project. And Lynn Tabernacki, who is it Brian that was here earlier?
Brian Hammond.
Yep, who Brian actually works with. She's very instrumental in what we do down there. So she wants to be a part of that financing structure where feasible. And in terms of the carbon credits, the carbon market in Europe just took a tumble over the last several years. You can go through the process to become carbon credit eligible, but it's very thin icing on the cake. It's probably worth going through the exercise, and if the carbon market comes back, it's an ancillary revenue stream, but it's insignificant right now. Yeah.
Thank you all very much. My favorite panel so far.
Yes.
I think this is probably going to be directed at Chris. And I apologize for the sort of the long lead into this. My client had a 2.7 megawatt wind project that was going in front of the utility company on one island, tanked at the last minute by an egregiously overcharged interconnection fee.
What island?
I can tell you that.
Oh, afterwards. It's a Caribbean island, though.
Caribbean island.
You didn't say Long Island, like New York.
No, not Long Island.
That would be the mafia.
Well, you know, wind turbines versus waste management.
I thought you said Long Island.
Another island has, which is one of your 10 island challenge, Turks in this case. I was reading their energy company's website. Very anti-renewable.
Yeah.
The Castalia study came back saying that they could handle 4% of penetration of renewables into their grid.
So Fortis is the Canadian company.
Yeah, Fortis.
Yeah.
Another island has a 100 kilowatt cap for behind the meter projects for commercial companies, and they've got a 1.5 gigawatt grid.
Okay.
So policy's all over the place.
Right.
And the challenge that I have for you, and I'm hoping you can tell me that this is the direction you're headed, is we need a clearinghouse like Desire for energy policy and behind-the-meter power and things that actual consumers can do. Because I've got interest in 6 projects in 4 countries. I have capital. It's all PPA-related. And we are completely flying blind trying to figure out what's going on. We talk to one government office, they say one thing. We talk to another government office, they say another thing.
Yeah.
And in order to put this on a balance sheet for an investor...
Yeah, it's tough. So what we work with Paul Hastings, who's providing pro bono legal services to the Carbon War Room right now. And when we go, we do our trip to the island to execute the MOU. They do a rigorous, you know, legal review of what the current situation is as far as grid code, net metering laws, IPP availability, and what the restrictions of that may be. IPP is independent power producer as opposed to having a monopoly. You and I can talk about that in depth. I don't know if we want to take this whole time up, but part of the Carbon War Room playbook process is that specific deep dive into their current policies and what tweaks we can make in the policy that doesn't turn off the utility, that maintains their, you know, profitability, if you will, but at the same time moves the renewable energy agenda forward. And we're doing that systematically, island by island, but once that community of practice is in place, we hope that that will take on a more organic approach. If you have questions about particular islands in the challenge, I can get, you know, specific with you. Yeah. Yeah, because I've been there. I was a renewable energy developer, you know, without any assistance. Yeah.
So why don't we take a few more questions, and then we'll, I think part of keeping this the best panel would be to end promptly. And so I'd like to do that and also relieve my esteemed panelists of their afternoon, or rather of their obligation here. So why don't we try to get one or two more questions in, and we'll address that to whomever they're directed to on the panel, and then we can provide some last remarks if anybody has some. Okay? So any final questions?
Hi. I wanted to ask something that hasn't been brought up so far. It's been skirted around. We've been talking about access. We've been talking about affordability. One of the things we haven't been talking about is the fact that in a lot of these countries, people don't pay their bills. And can we address a little bit from a investor perspective and a donor perspective how that risk, the customer risk, is mitigated in these projects?
That's a great question. I should add that it's not only the downstream people that are not paying their bills, it's your counterparty as a private sector investor, the state-owned enterprise. Exactly. In PREPA's case, PREPA has an $11 billion debt.
Yeah.
So who in their right mind would come in and say, hey, Tropigas, we're going to deal with that for you, or put it into the private insurance markets in the case of a performance bond or a bid bond and things like that. So it's a great question.
Definitely.
Do you want to try and tackle that one? Do you have any?
It's definitely a tough issue. It's definitely a tough issue. In Puerto Rico's case specifically, with the current financial situation, the degrading of the bonds, it's difficult to get investor support. We were lucky to have in our project, specific to our project, the savings were such that it's such an attractive measure that it pretty much, the payback is so fast, the return on investment is so ridiculously fast, that you can generate interest. And we secured financing through suppliers. Now, different island groups are going to have different issues. And that's where we go back to size, scope, demand for product. You know, it's difficult to justify $600 million, $700 million dollar LNG terminal for a 70 megawatt consumption. It's not difficult. It's impossible.
And shipping it that far.
And shipping. You know, so that's where you enter into this game, and that's why I think Vanessa has said on multiple occasions, each solution is tailor made for each individual island. And that's why, again, I completely agree with her on her mentioning that the Caribbean cannot be viewed as one unit. If you'd care to add.
I would just say that's a really classic case of a poor governance model.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you have, quite honestly, it raises costs for the utility if you have people in the distribution system who aren't paying. It raises the cost of investment, it raises the risk, it lowers the probability that a country would be able to make the investments that they would like to make. So at the end of the day, trying to resolve those sorts of issues on a case-by-case basis and see how, because very often it can become very political. I've heard of anecdotally stories in the Dominican Republic where when people went to disconnect the trees of illegal connections that were made, that people in those communities would actually attack the electricity workers doing so. So it has to be managed along multiple lines, and it has to be managed together with society and with government and with the private sector. But there's a pretty clear path that having tariffs that reflect the service, having people paying for the services that they receive is a basic cause and effect that is good governance.
Well, and I think on the political point, the other issue at hand, of course, across the Caribbean and many countries is that the public utility is a part of the political apparatus as opposed to genuinely something that's managed in the public interest. And so raising the price of energy for households isn't going to get a lot of people reelected. And so obviously a lot of these long-term challenges that we've debated in the entire day aren't going to get solved in the four-year electoral cycle.
Definitely.
So I think we'll. This is a very, very good natural pause. If there's any last remarks from our panelists.
We're good.
So then let me then say the final word, if I may, which is that the lesson of Venezuela, I think, should ring loud and clear to the islands and the nations and Puerto Rico and the territories in the Caribbean, which is that if your economy is dependent on one thing, whether it is your GDP or whether it is power in your nation, one energy source, the lessons of Venezuela ring true. And you know, obviously, the United States is under the leadership of Vice President Biden is trying to fill that void. We don't have a... Sorry?
May I just add one,
yes, you may,
one point
please.
To that? Very rude to interrupt you, but I just wanted to share one anecdote from the summit. One of the heads of state of one of the Caribbean countries said, you know, we hear you saying that no country should rely on just one sole provider, but we all want to. We all want to rely on ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. And with that being the last word, thank you all so much for withstanding the Caribbean heat and the great discussions that we've had today. So thanks again. And thank you once again to Tropigas for sponsoring.
Thank you.